From WYPR, I'm Sheila Kast. We're on the record. We think of species taking a long time to adapt to changes in their surroundings. Not necessarily, says evolutionary biologist and ecologist Menno Skilthosen. In his new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution, he asserts we don't have to look far for evidence.
Evolution is a very commonplace process. It's not something you need to travel to faraway places for, which you can only study by looking at fossils. It's something that goes on all the time everywhere, even in your backyard.
Skilthosen says plants and animals can adapt quickly to survive. Things like mating preferences and diets are in flux when it comes to city living. It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Kast. We're On the Record. Many scientists and naturalists bemoan how habitat is being lost because of the encroachment of humans in industrial development. Our guest today doesn't support that either, but he chooses instead to focus on the resilience of plants, animals, and insects that inhabit urban areas and the ways they evolve not only to survive but thrive. Evolutionary biologist and ecologist Menno Skilthosen is a senior research scientist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, and a professor of evolutionary biology at Leiden University. His new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution, is his latest look at how humans influence the environment. Welcome to On the Record, Menno.
Thank you very much.
What prompted you to look at urban areas as a way to study evolution?
Well, what prompted me was the idea that cities are expanding and cities are becoming a habitat in their own right. We're seeing that animals and plants are colonizing cities. They're finding ways to live with us. And to me, as an evolutionary biologist, that means that I'm expecting these places to be hotbeds for evolution, because cities are an extreme environment. They are made for people, by people. They're not made for wildlife, and yet wildlife manages to live here, but they probably need to adapt to all those special conditions that we create. So I'm expecting cities to be places where animals and plants evolve to adapt to those human-generated conditions. And that's always a very fascinating process to study, these rapid evolutionary changes, in this case caused by ourselves. I personally am concerned that species are going extinct because of the urbanization of the world, but that doesn't stop me as a biologist from being interested in the processes that go on in these places.
When people hear Darwin, they think of evolution that's very slow moving, but you show in Darwin Comes to Town how insects and plants are evolving faster than we could imagine in eating habits, mating habits, nesting habits. Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite examples?
Well, one of my favorite examples is actually the blackbird, the European blackbird, which is a close relative of the American robin, except that it's all black, and the male has a yellow beak. It's a very common species of bird in cities, but it hasn't always been that way. It used to be a very elusive forest bird right until the early 19th century. And then suddenly they started colonizing cities, initially in Germany. And this has been a process that's been going on for 200 years now. And because it's been such a long process of colonization of cities by these blackbirds, In this particular species, you see that a lot of things have changed in these urban blackbirds that is the result of evolution and is making these birds adapt to urban conditions. And it goes from the way they look. So the urban blackbirds have shorter beaks, which may have to do with the fact that they eat human food rather than digging, probing in the soil for worms. They don't migrate anymore. They breed much earlier in the year. They sing at a higher pitch. They do all these things that we see now in different species that have to do with adaptation to an urban environment. So this particular species, the European blackbird, I think is the pinnacle of urban evolution. That's why it's my favorite example. And it's actually the only case that we know of where it really seems that a new species is evolving in cities. All the other cases that we have, we don't really see that there's a new species evolving. We just see that certain characteristics of a species are changing in cities. But this urban blackbird is really a case in itself, which is why it's my favorite.
And you think it qualifies as a new species because there are so many changes, or is there some particular set of changes that you think make it a new species?
Yeah, it's a number of things. There, the fact that there are so many changes in different aspects of the looks and the physiology and the behavior of this species. So it's all over its genome, all over its DNA. There must be things changing. That's one reason. But also the fact that, for example, because they don't migrate anymore, in the ones that live in cities, whereas the ones that still live outside of cities in forests do migrate. This means that in cities, the blackbirds already start breeding very early in the spring before the migrants that have migrated away in winter have returned. So that means that they don't breed with each other anymore. And that's one of the, this inability to crossbreed is one of the definitions of a new species, that there's a permanent break of genetic interbreeding. And that's also a reason why I think it's on its way to becoming a separate species.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with evolutionary biologist, ecologist, and author Menno Skilthausen. His new book is Darwin Comes to Town: How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Skilthausen is also the author of Nature's Nether Regions: What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. You talked about the mating habits of the blackbirds changing in an urban setting. Mm-hmm. Other species where the mating habits seem to be affected?
Yeah, there's a few other birds where we see that their sex life is really changing in urban conditions. A very good example is an American example, the dark-eyed junco, a small songbird from California, which originally lived in, and still does, in the mountains in California. But a few decades ago, a few individuals that were overwintering on the campus of the San Diego University in San Diego stayed on during the summer and found it an urban population of this bird species at sea level in a very different climate than where the rest of the species lives in the mountains. And this has resulted in some peculiar changes in the mating habits of this species, because up in the mountains, it's quite high up. So there's only in the summer, there's a few months that it's warm enough for insects, which the birds feed on. So in the mountains, the male birds need to defend a territory very fiercely against other males, so that they can at least be sure that they can raise one clutch of young, one nest of nestlings, because there's so much competition for food there. And they do this defending of the territory by having aggressive displays with other males, in which the coloration of the tail and the head play an important role. So the tail of the dark-eyed junco has white feathers which they spread and they display, and that's a very important signal. If there's a lot of white in the tail, that this is a very aggressive male and it can defend its territory. And the same goes for the black coloration of the head. But in San Diego, the climate is much warmer. You can actually breed the whole year round. They start breeding already in February and they go on until October or November. So they can raise up to 4 nests per year, and there's not so much competition for territories. And also the females don't really value aggression in males anymore. And they also don't value those white flags in the tail and the darkness of the head. They prefer males who are good at helping to raise offspring rather than to help defend the territory against other males. So you see that in those urban populations of the dark-eyed junco, this coloration of the tail and of the head is disappearing. It's a genetic characteristic, and it seems that because they don't need it anymore and because the females don't value it anymore, they value different things. They value more like the metrosexual male, you could say, in these urban conditions. The whole mating system of this species is moving away from what has been the case for forever in those Californian mountains.
Why can the evolution of animals and insects in cities move so fast?
Yeah, Darwin himself thought that evolution cannot move that fast. He wrote, we don't see any of these changes in progress until the hands of time have marked the long lapse of ages. But since Darwin, we found many cases where evolution moves very fast indeed. And it can move fast if the benefit that a particular or an organism with a particular characteristic has is very great compared to what is normal in the species. And also if the generation time is short. If generation time is like the evolutionary clock speed, and insects, for example, which can have multiple generations per year, they can make changes very rapidly. So some of the cases that I describe in my book took place in just 10 or 12 years.
It's amazing. I get the sense that you support the concept of urban areas because so much change is taking place there. Does that mean you don't believe in conservation, per se?
No, I do. I do believe in conservation. I think that studying urban evolution is very important because whether we like it or not, cities are expanding and wildlife is colonizing cities. But cities cannot accommodate the majority of the biodiversity on Earth. We still need these pristine areas where rare species survive. And in fact, I'm also running an organization called Taxon Expeditions, where we take citizen scientists, so untrained biologists, into tropical areas, really biodiversity hotspots, where we discover new species which are unique to these places, to these really untouched, pristine areas in tropical jungles and elsewhere, which will never be able to live in cities. So for preserving all biodiversity on Earth, we really need those untouched areas as well. But I think that shouldn't mean that we cannot enjoy what's going on in the ecology of cities.
This book, Darwin Comes to Town, is very readable, even for readers without much background in science. And when you do use a complex term like phylogeography, you unpack it. So tell us about phylogeography.
Phylogeography is a branch of evolutionary science which uses DNA to understand how a species' history has been. So phylogeographers, they use the DNA from many individuals all over the range of a species to reconstruct the history and the timing of those historical events in a species' past. It helps us to understand how this evolutionary process in cities take place. A good example are the white-footed mice in parks in New York City. A colleague of mine, Jason Munshie South from Fordham University, has been studying the phylogeography of these native wild white-footed mice. These are not the mice that you find running in your apartment. These are really wild mice that live in forests in the East Coast U.S. and were living all over Manhattan and Brooklyn before the city was there. And now they're surviving in these small pockets of vegetation in city parks. And he's been studying the DNA of those species to see how their population has become fragmented as the city spread among them, but also how they have managed to adapt to the local conditions in these city parks. And he's noticing that some genes in certain parks are different from the mouse genes in other parks, depending on the local conditions. For example, the white-footed mice in Central Park, they have evolved genes which help them to deal with very fatty diet, which probably has to do with the fact that that's the most heavily visited park in New York, and there's a lot of junk food and peanuts and scraps of food around which these mice survive on. But it's not always very good for them to have this very fatty human diet, so they have evolved genes to help them to cope with that.
Fascinating. We need to take a quick break here. Biologist, ecologist, and author Menno Skilthausen is with us. We're talking about his new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. After the break, we'll ask about the upside of invasive species and telecoupling. I'm Sheila Kass. Stay with us on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking today with biologist, ecologist, and author Menno Skilthausen about his new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. It's an investigation into how humans and development affect the environment, sometimes in surprising ways. Invasive species is almost a dirty word to many naturalists, but you talk about their existence in urban areas in a more positive light. Why?
Well, I think invasive species, which are non-native species that spread very successfully in an area, I think they play a very important ecological role. And I think the resistance against them is very subjective. I don't think for the role that a species play in an ecosystem, it really matters where it's from. And in cities, which are such melting pots, culturally but also biologically, you see species living in cities that come from all over the world, having been brought in by people because of trade and garden centers and bird seeds, and there's all kinds of reasons why exotic species are living together in a city. Those food webs, those ecosystems are really running on species that come from all over the place, and they evolve while they are interacting with each other in such a way that they find and fine-tune their niches. And I think that's a very important process to very rapidly get well-functioning ecosystems in cities. And to me, it's a bit beside the point whether those species are native or non-native. What matters is whether they jointly can make a very healthy ecosystem. And in many cases, it turns out that they can just as well as native species can.
You introduce the term telecoupling, which sounds almost like science fiction. Tell us about telecoupling.
Yeah, telecoupling is a term that was first coined by a researcher named Marina Alberti from the University of Washington. And she points out that, and I think that's a very interesting idea, that this urban evolution that we're seeing in cities all over the world is not just sort of a curious way of looking at conventional evolution. It's really, in many ways, a new stage in the evolution of life on Earth, because cities are run by very different rules than ecosystems were in the past. So she says that cities are telecoupled, so that there are connections between cities, biological connections, which have to do with the fact that the species themselves are being transported from city to city because of traffic between them, but also that the innovations, the human innovations that these species are adapting to, are also moving from city to city. Let's, for example, say if a new innovation is developed in artificial lighting, like the LED lights that you're now seeing everywhere, that innovation spreads very rapidly from city to city. So all those urban ecosystems all over the world are sort of homogenized by invisible hands, which is something that normally doesn't really happen with habitats in the world. And in addition, they are changing faster as they become bigger, which is also contrary to what you see normally in natural habitats. In a rainforest, which is a very large, complex ecosystem, evolution is slowed down usually because niches get filled. But in cities, the bigger they get, the more quickly they change, because there's a lot of people together with a lot of new ideas being generated all the time. So the conditions in cities change faster if they are bigger. And that means that urban evolution is played by completely different rules than conventional evolution. And I think that's a very interesting way of looking at urban evolution. And it also means that it may introduce a new phase in the history of life on Earth. It could be a very momentous moment that we're living in at the moment.
That's ecologist and evolutionary biologist Menno Skilthausen here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kast. We're talking about his book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Skilthausen's earlier book is Nature's Nether Regions, What the Sex Lives of Bugs, Birds, and Beasts Tell Us About Evolution, Biodiversity, and Ourselves. You've carried out this research for a long time. What is the most surprising thing that you've come across?
Well, I think one of the most surprising things about studying urban evolution is that it's actually one of the few fields in evolutionary biology where we can get very important help from the general public. Because, I mean, normally when you're doing evolutionary research in remote areas, you cannot really get the general public to help you to study the organisms you're interested in. But in cities, you have millions of pairs of eyes that could help you in principle. And we know that citizen science is an upcoming field. So people are walking around with iPhones and other smartphones to document plants and animals and uploading them to citizen science websites. And I think that's a very powerful way to document what we're observing in terms of wild species evolving to suit these urban conditions. And I think it may actually be a way to generate what I would call an evoscope, a sort of a globalized urban evolution observatory. It's a bit of a dream of mine that we could use these large numbers of citizen scientists to really document the changes in the appearances of animals and plants in cities. And we've just finished a little pilot project in the Netherlands where we launched a smartphone app for people to upload pictures of a particular species of snail. And we've, using all those thousands of pictures that people have uploaded, we've managed to prove that in cities where you have these urban heat islands where the temperature is much higher, that the snails have lighter colored shells, which probably has to do with the fact that these light shells reflect the sun's heat better, and it protects these snails against overheating in the summer, which is much more important in cities than outside of cities, because it's hotter in cities than in the countryside. And I think if we introduce similar systems for other species, we could build a global urban evolutionary research program that everybody can participate in. And I think that would be a very exciting development.
So you're talking about going beyond the kind of citizen scientist census counts of butterflies or birds and actually chronicling changes in species.
Yeah, exactly. Because until now, citizen science websites like iNaturalist and apps that use the same system, they've mostly been used for documenting the presence or absence of particular species. But since people are making pictures, you can also use those pictures to see how those species look. And using image recognition, for example, you can measure differences in the coloration or the shape or the size of species. And we can actually use those data to watch species change their appearance.
Do you think climate change or human urban development has had more impact on natural habitat?
I think probably they go hand in hand. Climate change, of course, is very important. We're aware of that. But habitat change, I think, is at least as big an impact on the Earth's ecosystems. But they do go hand in hand, because often you see that the climate, if vegetation disappears, the climate also changes. So I think you cannot really separate the two. But I think together they are a tremendously fast and tremendously pervasive change in the ecology of the planet.
Have your findings made you look to the future of the planet with more hope or despair?
Hard to say. It depends a bit on what scale you're looking at. I think it's on the short term, if we can maintain the sort of population density in humans that we have now, then I think with this increased interest in urban ecology and urban evolution, we might be able to build more livable cities. But whether we will be able to sustain these huge populations of humans in the long term, I don't know. If you're looking at the history of other species, you see that after such a boom cycle, there comes a bust, and the bust may come sooner or later. But I think it's something that we need to take into account in our predictions for the future.
What would you like people to come away with from reading Darwin Comes to Town?
What I think is really important is that people realize that evolution is a very commonplace process. It's not something you need to travel to faraway places for, or which you can only study by looking at fossils. It's something that goes on all the time. It's a law of nature. It's something that goes on all the time everywhere, even in your backyard.
I'm really grateful to you for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, too.
Menno Skildhuizen is an evolutionary biologist and ecologist. We've been discussing his new book, Darwin Comes to Town, How the Urban Jungle Drives Evolution. Skildhuizen is senior research scientist at Naturalis Biodiversity Center in Leiden, the Netherlands, and a professor of evolutionary biology at Leiden University. We have links to information about Darwin Comes to Town at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us on the record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.